Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer günstig und natürlich mit dem Aldi-Tiefpreisversprechen. Zum Beispiel knackiges Gemüse, saftiges Obst, frische Backwaren. Kurz gesagt, mehr Frische für alle. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote zum Tiefpreis in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. Joining me today, as always, my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, everyone. Hope you're doing well today.
And this is a three-person pod, at least for the first segment. Joining me is our good friend, Ash Paulson.
Yay.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm super excited to be here.
Ash is a regular on Game Explain, and he is an RPG aficionado. He's just crazy for his RPGs. Also a big Mega Man nut, which means that Nadia, of course, loves him.
Yes, we have had our exchanges about Mega Man in the past, and we've actually both done work for Udon. So you work at Udon, so.
Well, yeah, I used to at least. Yeah, it's kind of crazy how our Mega Man paths have crossed in various ways over the years. But yeah, we did some Mega Man stuff at Udon together, and we've talked about plenty of Mega Man. And I can't wait till you get to play Mega Man 11 so we can talk about it together.
We'll have a nice conversation together, nice peaceful conversation.
Yes.
I love Ash because he has extremely strong opinions that aren't always in the mainstream. For example, Ash, you really love Mega Man 5. Like, that is, like, one of your favorite games.
I do. I do, despite the fact that I recognize that it's flawed. I'm not going around saying, oh, it's the perfect Mega Man game. It definitely is not, but despite its flaws, I really do love it.
I like 5, too. I like 4 as well. I actually really like 4 and 7, which are the ones that people hate the most.
I hate 7 so much.
No, I like 7
is not good. 7 is real bad. I would go as far as to say it's the worst numbered Mega Man.
You're outnumbered 2-1, 2-3 here.
It's almost as bad as 6.
How could you... What?
6
is aged so well. How could you say such a thing? Especially in a world where Mega Man and Bass exists.
That's true.
But Ash has good opinions as well. Like, for example, he loves Chrono Trigger.
That's a good opinion.
Yes, I do.
The reason we brought him on the show today was... So he did the review for Ys 8 on the Nintendo Switch. And it jumped out immediately because Ys 8 has had a kind of a troubled localization period.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And just for some background, Falcom recently went over to NIS America to do this localization for Ys 8. Previously, I believe they've been with Exceed.
Yes, Exceed.
And it's just been not super great for Falcom because Ys 8, I would actually, in the relatively limited scope of the hardcore JRPG, I would say Ys 8 is a fairly... big project. I mean, Polygon mm-hmm. called it one of the most underrated RPGs of last year, and you would really hope that they would kind of crush the localization, but instead it's been completely the opposite. I would go as far as to say that it's been a disaster.
Yeah.
They went and completely relocalized the game, and somehow it's even worse.
Yeah, and it's not just the localization, as I understand it. There was a disastrous PC release, and like that's where Ys has always had its strongest fan base. That's where I first played Ys, was on the PC, and just the day before it was supposed to come out on PC, apparently they just dropped it and didn't explain why for a long time. And then when they finally brought it back, it was just a mess of a port, and it's just not fair to what's actually a great game. Because I too gave Ys 8 one of my slots on my 2017 Game of the Year list.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't quite understand either, because it's not as if all the localization issues, they're not like early PS1 day localization-esque problems like This Guy Are Sick. Like, it's stuff, there is some weird-sounding text, but it's actually mostly stuff that's like text formatting and repeated lines, and lines that clearly are not meant to be where they are. And there's even one, you can see in my review, actually, on Game Explain, there's one line, at least, where the text starts English and then ends in Japanese. Like it's not a fully translated line.
I saw that on your review, and I laughed my ass off, because I'm actually used to seeing, like phrases where they're fully Japanese, but I've never seen something where it starts English and ends Japanese. That was great.
I have never seen such a thing. I don't think in my life playing video games. And I it just defies explanation. Like, what in the world happened here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was supposed to be the fixed localization as well. I remember there was a unlocalized line in a very specific circumstance on SMT4 Apocalypse, I want to say. And Atlas was just completely mortified and apologized profusely and everything, especially because they couldn't easily... I think they could fix it on the 3DS because you could push a patch.
But, yeah, you can patch it.
But certainly nothing on this level. And it's just... It's a pity that this is a thing because I really want Ease 8 to do well and succeed. And I was hoping that the Nintendo Switch would be a little bit of a, I suppose, coming out party for it. They do say that they're going to have multiple launch day patches. I believe three of them.
Wow.
To fix up the text. And the game's not technically out, I don't think. I think it comes out on the 27th, I want to say, Ash.
I think it's the 26th.
The 26th, yeah.
The 26th. Yeah, so it'll be out next week. So there's still time to kind of address it. And I really do hope that they address it because it's just been an ongoing mess for Ease 8. And I can't imagine that Falcom is particularly happy with NAS America at the moment.
No. Does anyone know why the Switch was made? Because Xseed always did a fantastic job. Just why would you suddenly switch like that?
Well, I mean, it's from my understanding, talking to the CEO last year, was that they really, NIS America has been after Falcom for a long time.
Mm.
And I did not get specifics, but I have to imagine that they gave them a solid publishing deal and they said, all right, yeah, we'll go with you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and now they've been burned by both Xseed and seemingly NIS America. And it's like, where do you go? I mean, there are other, obviously, you know, translation houses, but the track record for this game, as you both have been saying, it's just kind of crazy. And kind of speaking to what you were saying, Nadia, it is a real shame because I didn't play Ease 8 back in 2017 when it originally released.
Right.
I did play the PS4 demo and I really liked it, but I just never got around to playing it. And I had never played an Ease game before. Like, I'd always kind of existed around the series and appreciated it, but I always wanted to get into it. And so I finally did for this review for the Switch version. And it's a fantastic game. Like, it is so underappreciated and underrated, and it flew under the radar completely. And this game deserves a localization that is as good as it is.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, I agree. And something else I noticed in your review was the, I don't ask for 60 frames per second on the Switch. I just don't. But you mentioned frame rate drops, especially with boss fights, and I don't think there's an excuse for that.
Yeah, and it's not just boss fights. It's not really even just boss fights. It's any time things get really hectic in combat, but even more often when you swing the camera around and you're like, you got some crazy landscape shots.
Right.
Like, it happens a lot in Castaway Village when you're just kind of panning the camera around it, you know, and various parts of the environment swing into view, and it really gets choppy. Like, I would say down into the 20s, maybe even high 10s. I'm not, you know,
wow,
exactly sure.
And Castaway Village is not a very busy, like, place. Like, it's just the hub where you and your characters kind of interact, isn't it? If I'm remembering
right,
correctly.
Yeah, exactly. And then there are other parts of Castaway Village, I would say most of it, where it's completely smooth. So it's very inconsistent performance. And I mean, I'm obviously not an engineer, but from what I played of the PS4 version of Ease 8, it didn't seem to me like there were such crazy graphics being pushed that the Switch version would need to be compromised this much. And
this
does really seem to me to be like an optimization issue.
Yeah, because, PlayStation 4 was 60 frames per second. It was quite consistent, as I recall. But if the Switch can do Breath of the Wild without much of a problem, it sure as hell can do Ease 8 without a problem.
You would think so. It was interesting, though, because I was talking to the general manager of Panic Button during E3, and you can go read a couple articles that I did with them. Regarding, say, the Nintendo Switch's, prospects as the next generation kind of comes along, whether or not, for example, third-party games have already maxed out the Nintendo Switch's capabilities. And he said that one of the problems is trying to optimize a game that wasn't built for the Nintendo Switch, for the Nintendo Switch.
Sure.
And specifically, like, I don't know when Ease 8 was originally started development, but I sincerely doubt that it was originally pitched for the Nintendo Switch or built with the Nintendo Switch in mind.
Probably not, no.
Right, yeah.
And what I'm kind of getting is that the Nintendo Switch is... there's a lot going on there. You have to deal with battery issues and that sort of thing. And so what optimization is a kind of a delicate art when you're porting over a game like Ease 8.
Yeah,
like, I think that if it had been built from the start with the Nintendo Switch in mind, rather than just trying to port it over, like porting over this extremely complicated game, which Ease 8 is a complicated game, well, I think that they would have an easier time.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. Except I don't think there's any reason for it to go down into the tens when you have Castaway Village, which is just like a village with a few people living in it, you know?
Well, now, to be fair, that's just my own estimation. I don't have, you know, I don't have a frame counter.
Right, right.
So, but it does, it really drops down. Now, of course, those drops are always very temporary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, on the other hand, I do want to say and congratulate the engineers for the fact that they got such a massive... complicated game running at all on the Switch. Not that the Switch couldn't handle it, but the fact that you could take a game like Ease 8 in handheld mode and play it on the go with this massive world to explore and still, you know, appreciable performance. It may not be amazing, but it's pretty solid on handheld mode, and the graphics look good enough, especially on that small screen. So the fact that this game, a game like this, is playable at all in a handheld format, I think is really impressive. So I don't want to go too hard on the graphics here, performance, and be like, wow, they did a terrible job.
Right.
There is certainly an impressive aspect of it, but it's mainly the TV mode aspect I'm talking about.
That is so weird.
Handheld mode, it really, really shines.
That is weird, because usually it's the opposite. Usually docked mode is, although there is a Vita version of the game, which I have not played it. I don't know how well it performs, but that's another, I guess, standard to kind of hold up the Switch version against if someone else out there wants to comment on it.
I have heard, and I've checked out some comparisons myself on YouTube, and I've heard from other people that the Switch version definitely comes in closer to the PS4 version in terms of overall, you know, textures,
right,
graphical fidelity. So it's definitely not a glorified Vita port. It's certainly closer to the PS4 version.
Okay, that's good to know.
Not,
yeah,
obviously up to that standard.
Right. Yeah. Still, the dock thing is pretty funny, and I'm glad to hear that it is better in handheld mode, because I do plan to buy this game specifically because I want to play it in handheld mode.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, that's kind of the great thing about the Switch screen, too, is, you know, when you're downscaling to 720p like that, you know, even graphics that may not look quite as good as you'd like on a giant TV, mm-hmm, are going to look a lot better, you know, per pixel on that small screen.
So yeah, I agree.
It really does shine in a handheld context, I think, on Switch.
The first thing I wanted, when I watched your review, Ash, the first thing I wanted to do was delete it from my Switch and go get it on the PS4.
Yeah, I mean, and I was brutally honest about that. I'm like, hey, this is a great game no matter where you play it, but if you foresee yourself playing it at home and you have multiple platforms and you have a PS4, get that version. Because as I'm playing through for the review, I'm like, I have this slight, just like, tinge of regret in my head. Like, man, I really wish I was playing this fantastic game on the PS4 just because it looks and runs so much better.
Right.
And this is coming from someone who isn't usually, you know, a graphics snob. Like, I don't consider myself that at all. I'm usually perfectly fine with, you know, graphical downgrades and things like that, but it just runs so smoothly on PS4.
Yeah, it looked really good on the PS4.
Not only that, like, it's not a graphical showcase, as it were, but it is a pretty good-looking game,
yeah, yeah,
and it relies heavily on these really big monster fights, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this exploring this open world, and I think that when you can nail a 60 frames per second, I think that really helps perceptually.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Especially because, you know, the combat itself is very arcadey, I would say.
Yeah.
It's just very, yeah, it's just the controls are very slick, very sharp, and there's an immediacy and kind of a freeform element to the combat that just makes it feel almost like you're playing an arcade game. And those kinds of, you know, that kind of gameplay, those kinds of action games, combat-heavy games, really do benefit from 60 frames per second a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I actually wonder if we've heard about a patch for the translation. I wonder if we're going to see any sort of patch on day one for the camera jank you were speaking of earlier.
Well, I kind of don't think so, only because we also got an email from an NIS representative talking about a review, saying, hey, we saw your review, we liked it, but we noticed that you said that the localization was deeply unprofessional. Just so you know, there are three patches coming to address those issues. But they didn't. I also did talk about the graphical issues. So I feel like if they were going to address those, they probably would have said.
Yeah, I think you're right
at that point. So, but for the record, we haven't actually we were going to pin a comment to the top of my review saying, "Hey, here these patches are coming," but they haven't come yet. Of course, it's not launch day yet. So I'm kind of waiting.
Let's say I bought Ease 8 on a Nintendo Switch, and I didn't have an easy way to get, say, my Switch on the internet, which is still a thing.
Yeah.
It's still a thing in some places, in some locations. So now I've got a completely broken localization on my game. I don't think that just because they have patches on the way means that they're necessarily free of criticism.
I completely agree.
Yeah,
and that's why even Andre at Game Explained, he was like, well, I mean, we were talking about how they forgot to tell us there were patches on the way at all. Like, I had no idea that these patches even existed until a couple of days ago when they remembered to email us about them, which is great. But as Andre was saying, and I agree with him, that doesn't absolve them of anything. I mean, I'm still reviewing the game as it was at the time that I
absolutely
played.
Actually, the first time I even heard about the patches was they were talking about the game and probably a review on Reset Era. And someone from NIS America was like, oh yeah, we're getting patches out for that, those problems soon. And people on the board were like, you might want to say something because reviews are mentioning this and we have no idea that this is coming.
Yeah, I mean, we had no clue about that. And I certainly would have mentioned it in my review if I had known that. But I mean, at the same time, though, as we've all been saying, this is their second go around, not NIS's necessarily, but this is Falcom's, unfortunately, second go around trying to get this game localized properly.
And
how are they even in this position is what I want to know.
That's like, what I like to know.
How did they even get here?
I'm so surprised. I mean, I got to be honest with you. I did not have a big problem with the localization the first time around. I don't remember there being the errors that you pointed out in your review. Maybe they were there and I just completely glossed over them, but I don't think I did. Maybe the dialogue was a bit rough, but this isn't exactly a very story-heavy game, so it didn't really bother me that much. But I will be bothered by bad word wrap and spelling errors and untranslated sentences.
Right. Well, and that's what's funny is, from what I recall of the initial translation, really all I saw of it was the PS4 demo, as well as what I played at the PlayStation conference last year, Kat, when I was with you and I were talking, and I played some Ease 8. And I do recall that the problems with that localization were more of the, like I said earlier, the Final Fantasy VII variety, where it's not natural, and it obviously reads as something that was translated very loosely from Japanese.
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed, like, just to hear that your review, Ash, not because you did a bad review, your review was great, just the fact that I was like, how could they screw it up twice in two very different interesting ways?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. They came so close to completely sticking the landing. And, I mean, I would have given it a love it easily, despite any, you know, performance problems. You know, that performance problems or graphics issues don't usually bring a game's score down for me unless it's, like, something really, really serious.
Right.
And, no, that would not have affected my score or brought it down. But I had to bring my score down just because as much as I love the game, and I really do, I just cannot look the other way with so many obvious polish problems. I just simply cannot.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about this, thinking back, I remember you saying, like, oh, I'm reviewing Ease 8 or whatever, and that was quite a long time ago, so I'm surprised now the last second they're addressing these localization issues.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think that at some point during the review process, they might have wanted to push out those patches a little earlier so I could, you know, realize, hey, there's a patch that's fixing all this stuff and I can talk about that in the review. But it literally was not until after the review was live, like the day after it went live, that NIS emailed us and they're like, hey, by the way, these patches are coming. And we're like, okay, well, we will let them know about these patches when they actually start showing up, basically.
It strikes me as damage control, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it kind of does. And that's really a shame. Ash, you mentioned earlier about XSEED and saying how they blew it. I can't remember. Did XSEED do the original translation for the PS4, or did they screw up another Ease game?
I could be incorrect about that. I thought they did the first translation for the PS4 version. I thought that they were responsible for that, but I could be incorrect.
I can't remember. We're
talking, Nihon Falcom published Ease 8, so they would have been the ones behind it.
Ah, okay. Then my bad.
Okay, that would explain why there are a lot of people, a lot of Ease fans, understandably, who are like, NIS America really screwed this up. Let's go back to XSEED. So that would explain that.
Yeah. And if you look at XSEED, if you look at the games that have been coming out from them over the past, you know, year or so, I mean, we have like SNK Heroines Tag Team Frenzy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they did do Danganronpa V3 last year, which is very text heavy and that kind of thing.
Right.
So this isn't the absolute biggest thing, but this has to be one of their bigger and more complicated projects what is really a pretty small outfit. And it must have just been there must have been some kind of big challenge going on behind the doors, or
right,
they were having some kind of budget constraints or something. But the fact that they went and completely relocalized it, that could not have been cheap.
No, it really couldn't have. And that was a really good gesture, actually. The fact that, as I said earlier, I didn't have a huge problem with the translation, but these fans who were very dedicated to the franchise, they did. So they said, okay, we'll do right by you this time. And I hear that the repatched translation on the PS4 is fine. So there you go, I guess.
And hopefully that's what they're patching into the Switch version. Like, it's so weird. And, you know, and to be perfectly clear, I want to say that having been a career editor in the past, it's not easy.
No,
like,
absolutely
I'm not saying that this is something that should have been easy for them to do and push out the door without even thinking about it. Like, localizing anything, especially a game with this much text and, you know, Nadia, you know, just like I do, there is a massive amount of text in this game.
Yes, there is quite a bit.
It's a huge Herculean effort. And, like, I absolutely, like, my respect goes out to the people who had to take this on. But at the end of the day, there's still no excuse for how things, you know, made it into the game the way they are now.
Right, I agree.
Yeah, launch patches, just because you got a launch patch doesn't mean that it's okay, because not everybody is going to have access to this launch patch, potentially. If it's just out of the box, it's broken in some way, or the localization is bad, that's not super
I don't want to be like, oh, in my day, blah, 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 but, like, there was a time when you had no option to patch. When it went to cartridge, it was done. You could not go back
And then
it.
They became beloved glitches.
They sure did.
Sometimes. Remember what happened with Twilight Princess?
Oh, that, God, that was terrible.
Canon glitch.
The canon glitch.
Yeah. So in the worst case scenarios, like, before patching was possible, or at least easily possible, that could completely ruin a game. And, I mean, imagine if we were living in an era still where this game was being released without the ability to easily patch it. I mean, it would be not a broken game, but it would be a partially broken one, at least.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Suikoden 2, which was just a fantastic game that had a terrible translation, deserved so much better. There was actually, that's another game, again, where there was untranslated Japanese text.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. But at the end of the day, you would still, I mean, generally recommend it for the Nintendo Switch.
Oh, yeah, in a second. I mean, if you like action RPGs, if you're a fan of the genre, and you don't have access to a PS4, and you can see yourself playing this game on the go a lot, 100% recommend it without any reservations. I mean, it's a special series, and it didn't take very long for me to play, or playing East 8, for me to see why it has lasted as long as it has and endured. It really is a special series, and it is very much its own flavor of Japanese action RPG. And I see a lot of other reviews, I have to say. I don't usually call out other reviews, but I have seen some other reviews comparing it to Xenoblade, and I don't see that.
No, I don't see that at all.
It's not Xenoblade-like at all.
So
anyone out there who's like, oh, I don't know if I'll like it because of the Xenoblade comparisons, don't worry about that. It's not... Sure, there are certain broad strokes you can paint between Xenoblade and East, like the fact that there are stats and the characters have HP.
And basically, that's where it ends, isn't it? Like,
at the very best,
you could say it's Zelda-ish, but even so, it still has its very unique traits.
Exactly. So, yeah, definitely don't even think about any sort of Xenoblade comparisons. In my opinion, the two, I didn't even think of the two, like, at all when I was playing East. I didn't think of comparing them at all. So, yeah, I don't quite get where people are getting that point.
Yeah, that is a weird comparison, when I have to say that. And I love both series, and it's still weird.
Well, before I let you go, did anything stand out to you from E3 in an RPG aspect? And what's the most anticipated RPG for the rest of the year for you, if anything?
Oh, man, put me on the spot here.
yes.
Well, so does this include action RPGs, turn-based, everything?
Whatever you like.
Man. Just don't go come out and go, you know what I'm really looking forward to in an RPG context? Black Ops 4.
Definitely not.
FIFA.
Man, you're really twisting my arm here, because my two main answers are, of course, Kingdom Hearts 3, but also Octopath Traveler. I am so hyped for Octopath Traveler, it hurts. And I've been listening to it, what little of the soundtrack we have so far, on repeat for the past, like, couple of weeks.
It's nice,
and,
isn't it?
It really is. And it's just, everything they're doing with Octopath Traveler just checks off every box that personally just makes me gleeful. Like the FF6 style sprites, but in high definition with the 3D graphic style. And that is one of the most video gamey like video game soundtracks I've heard in a long time. It's just so raw.
Yeah.
But on the other side of that, Kingdom Hearts 3. And I've watched all those E3 trailers far more many times than I would care to admit. And I've been looking forward to this game like other fans for like 12 years now. So it's one of those two games. Do I have to pick one?
We won't make you.
All right.
No, you got to pick one. You got to pick one.
Oh, that's Cass' idea, not me.
Got to pick it.
All right, Kingdom Hearts 3.
This is a real Sophie's choice right here.
Kingdom Hearts 3. It's got to be that. I've been waiting too long to see how this story ends.
Yeah, it'll be out
in January.
You think the story's going to end? You really think it's going to end?
This arc of the story. The arc. So
it'll be back in 10 years.
Yeah, and it is coming out in 2019 now. So if you were to say this year specifically, Octopath Traveler, without a doubt.
Okay, that's fair. I think that's fair.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kingdom Hearts 3 sure seems like they airlifted a PS2 game right into 2018, which I'm fine with.
Mechanically, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, just the look and the feel and everything about it just brings me way back to the 2000s, like the mid-2000s.
That doesn't surprise me. Unfortunately, despite my greatest attempts, I was not able to play Kingdom Hearts 3D3.
Really?
Well, it's weird, because I must have sent about 50 emails back and forth between Square Enix and us at Game Explain, setting up appointments, and they are happy to give us as much access as we want to Shadow of the Tomb Raider, Dragon Quest XI, Just Cause 4, the new Captain Awesome Life is Strange game. Like, they're happy, but as soon as I even mention Kingdom Hearts 3 in a reply, I get stonewalled, and I cannot figure it out.
Wow.
And it's not as if we cover Tomb Raider all that much on Game Explain. We do cover Kingdom Hearts.
Right.
So we are all, like, Andre, Derek, and I are all just flabbergasted. We have no idea
why we're
so involved with Kingdom Hearts, but there it is. But I did get extended time with Mega Man 11 once again, so that kind of made up for it.
There you go.
Heard the man. You heard the man, Square Enix. Give him some time with Kingdom Hearts 3.
Please.
Jeez.
I know. We can't wait for it, and we're happy to cover it on the channel. So
the channel's up to almost a million subs, which, by the way, congratulations on that.
I'm surprised they still all do. That's nuts.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that fact.
You're an influencer now.
Email. Yeah, like, I mentioned that. Like, hey, we're a media outlet with almost a million subscribers. Like, hey, we would love to cover Kingdom Hearts, and they just don't reply. So... Alas. It is what it is, but thank you for the compliment. We're within 50,000 subscribers now. We're within shooting distance of a million, which we're very excited about.
Well, make sure to smash that like button, rate, and subscribe, and
hit the
all
bell.
Of that stuff. And Ash, we'll have you back on the show real soon.
I'm looking forward to it. Thanks again, you guys, for having me on.
It's great having you.
And I'm looking forward to coming back sometime.
Okay, Nadia, thanks to Ash for joining us. So last week we teased a new series that we would be doing, and that series is the top 25 RPGs, according to Axe of the Blood God. And the original impetus for this project was last year. IGN and Game Informer released their top 100 RPG list, like pretty much at the same time. And
I remember that, yes.
I'm not a big fan of top 100 lists because I feel like people, they're so big that they kind of lose all meaning. It's better to just, and people only really care about the top 25, right?
I agree. That's when people start to bring out their claws and froth each other. But yeah, I get lost with top 100 anything.
And this podcast has been going for, I think, about 160 episodes at this point. We've existed since early 2015. We've never really just said, like, put down our flag and said, all right, these are the 25 RPGs.
Right.
Right here.
Right. So it's about time.
So this is the way we're going to do it. We're going to do one a week. We're going to do that for the next 6 months. But we really want to give each one the time and the love that it deserves. We don't want to just give it a capsule.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to... I don't think you can really encapsulate these games in a couple hundred words. I think we really need to talk about... Let's talk about them, Nadia.
Yes, we'll sit down with our coffee and talk.
And we're going to have a companion piece on the website, too. Mm-hmm. So keep an eye on the website as well for the companion piece. And eventually, we're going to build it out to a nice big hub. And that will be the top 25 RPGs, according to Axe of the Blood God. Stay tuned for, like, next January for for number one. But, I mean, that's a good reason to keep following us, right?
I agree. Please look forward to it.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a little musical cue in here, and you can kind of figure out what number 25 is right here. Yep, that's right, Nadia. Number 25 on this list, and maybe a surprise to some people. We're starting out controversial, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Number 25 is Final Fantasy V, the middle Super Nintendo game, a game that a lot of people considered a black sheep for a very long time. And one thing I want to say is, don't worry, we're not going to put every freaking Final Fantasy on this list. if anything, I kind of went out of my way to avoid trying to put like multiple games from a particular series on here. Yeah. There's only one other Final Fantasy on this list. I'm going to spoil you right now.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then there's one other series that gets multiple games, and that's about it. I think Final Fantasy is easier to do in this case because every Final Fantasy kind of stands on its own.
It does, doesn't it? Like, more so than Dragon Quest, even, I have to admit. Final Fantasy games like to experiment quite a bit.
Yes. I mean, every Final Fantasy is kind of its own beast, and that doesn't make it feel redundant as opposed to, say, I don't know, yeah, every Mass Effect is different, but at the end of the day, it's like, kind of pick one, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's hard to do that with Final Fantasy.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do that, but Final Fantasy V. So just let's start with a little background, Nadia. This is the fifth game, 5 years after the original, has five boss themes and five main characters. I'm sensing a pattern right here.
Yeah, there's a bit of a pattern going on. And it was, you mentioned it was the black sheep of the family. And I wonder if it comes across as that to us, because it was not a game that we had for a very long time. And in fact, I think one of the first fan-translated RPGs most of us played was Final Fantasy V.
Yes, Chris Kohler was actually one of the fans who helped translate it back in the mid-90s, way back in the day, mid to late 90s, I want to say.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I think he actually went as far as to, he was on the show actually talking about what he did to get the game. Like, he went to, like, import shops across California. He ordered it online eventually, I believe is what he did. And he basically translated the game himself, or at least as much as he could.
Yes, he was. Yes, he did. You're right, though, when you're saying that it's actually more of an American thing. This might be apocryphal, but there have been reports or the hearsay, I suppose you could say, that it's actually more popular than Final Fantasy VI in Japan.
Yeah, I've heard that myself, and I don't have a hard time believing it, to be honest with you. I once went to the Square Enix Symphony in Baltimore, and it's funny, they played Clash on the Big Bridge, which, of course, we know that song quite well now. But when they played it, they said, this is one we get requested in Japan a lot, but nobody here really knows what it is.
This is a great song.
It's a great song. It's what plays when you fight Gilgamesh, isn't it?
I want to say yes.
Yeah.
it's a phenomenal song. And then, in fact, there are multiple phenomenal boss themes and remixes and everything. I feel like a lot of Americans maybe were exposed to Battle on the Big Bridge in theater rhythm.
Theater rhythm, and also I think there's a remix of it in Final Fantasy XII.
But I think there are a few reasons that it's really popular in Japan versus here. And one of them is it is much more lighthearted than a lot of Final Fantasy games. It's not as story focused. It's much more grindy and gameplay focused. And this is painting with a broad brush, but the impression that I've always gotten has been that just pure grinding is a very popular thing to do. It's almost meditative in Japan.
I've never heard that before, but that makes a lot of sense. Grinding is, if I'm in the mood, it's something I like to do as well, and meditative is a good way to put it.
There's somebody else who really loves Final Fantasy V, and that is Hironobu Sakaguchi, who purportedly said that it was his favorite Final Fantasy prior to 9.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes. But he worked together with Yoshinori Kitase. Kitase brought out a lot of the humor in the game. It was originally a fairly serious script, but he decided to make it a lot more lighthearted. And If there's one thing that a lot of people praise Final Fantasy V for, is that the characters have almost a kind of a familial feel to them.
Mm-hmm. They are a little bit goofy, and that's actually quite a contrast from 4 and 6.
And, Tetsuya Nomura stepped in. I was like, he was already at Square at this point, but this was, he got to be a monster designer in this one.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe Nomura.
And the job system was designed by Hiroyuki Ito. And this game stands out because it is really kind of the last game, last traditional Final Fantasy. And when I say traditional, I mean in the vein of the first kind of five games in the series, where they still had the crystals. This is the last one that really, truly had the crystals, right?
They were totally crystal-oriented, you're right, yes.
And this was also, I believe, the last game before Hironobu Sakaguchi got kicked upstairs over at Square, Squaresoft. And Final Fantasy VI really marked a period where kind of the next generation started to rise up. And Sakaguchi was busy with many more other things. So he had perhaps a more direct hand in the creation of this game than with some of the games that would follow.
Yeah, and it's actually funny that you say that, because thinking back, Final Fantasy I, Final Fantasy III, and Final Fantasy V, those were all very heavily oriented around the job system. And for a lot of Final Fantasies after that, we didn't see the job system.
Yep. So, obviously, as you've heard, Americans did not get this game for quite a while, because Nintendo decided that it was just not accessible. Final Fantasy II did not sell as well or as fast as they perhaps had hoped. Console RPGs at the time were seen as kind of a non-starter over here in America. They were seen as more of a PC genre and a very hardcore genre at that. So as a consequence, we didn't get it. And that's why it doesn't have kind of the same nostalgic aspect of Final Fantasy IV and VI.
Yeah. And then games were actually, localizing them was a much more intensive process back then. It took a very long time.
Yes. So when it finally came out, it came out in, I want to say, 2000 with Final Fantasy Anthology on the PlayStation. And this is the first time for a lot of Americans to really kind of grapple with this game. And unfortunately, it had a really, 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 really bad localization. Maybe the theme of this episode is bad localizations. That had an atrocious localization.
Yeah, that made Ys 8 look like Shakespeare. It was pretty awful. That was where the Wyvern was called the Wyburn, which is a great name.
That's my absolute favorite one. And the main character is named Butts.
Butts. Somebody looked at that and said, that's a great idea for a character. Well, we have Cecil in Final Fantasy IV, and we have Butts.
And Tina from Bob's Burgers just went, huh? My new favorite character. it was not benefited from that. It also struggled with just really bad load times.
Right. Those were atrocious.
Yeah, you had the cool, I'm going into a battle, and it didn't benefit from the fact that it was side-by-side with Final Fantasy VI, which was kind of the pinnacle of what the SNES, one of the pinnacle games of the SNES, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Just
in terms of sheer scope, graphically, Final Fantasy VI was much better. So Final Fantasy V looked downright primitive on the PlayStation.
Yeah, it did. It kind of really struck that in that middle ground between 6 and 5, and 4 graphically. I mean, it's not the most impressive looking game at all ever, but it doesn't need to be.
And also, the really bad localization did not bring out the humor in the script.
Mm-hmm,
and
exactly.
Humor was a huge component of Final Fantasy V, especially with characters like Gilgamesh. So what people who were just coming off Final Fantasy VII were walking into was a very challenging, hardcore RPG with a terrible localization, notably worse graphics.
Mm-hmm.
And a very light story. And if coming off Final Fantasy VI and VII and VIII, it was just like, it felt ancient.
It felt like, I understand why this game was never localized for us. And that really wasn't really fair to the game.
Yes. And so it took a long time, I feel like, for it to finally build an audience. And over the years, it's been released on the GBA. It's been where it got a much better script.
Mm-hmm.
Most people see that as one of the better ones. It's also been released on Steam and iOS. It's Bartz, now Bartz, got a nice starring role in Final Fantasy Dissidia.
Right.
And I think got more of a fan base because of that. And over time, I think that opinions toward Final Fantasy V have definitely softened.
Yes, they definitely have. And even to this day, I don't know if people are making it for lost time or if it's just that good of a game, probably the latter. But people still have, they play Final Fantasy V and they have it down to a science and they still find ways to screw around with it. And that's, I find that really impressive. That really speaks to how well and how deep the game works.
So let's dive in a little deeper. So the way we're going to do this in general is that we're going to talk about kind of what makes each of these games stand out and just why we're putting them on this list. We're going to talk about some of the best moments from the game. We're going to talk about why it still holds up, and we're going to talk about how you should play it and how you can play it at this moment. Thankfully, Final Fantasy V is relatively easy to find, but there are some versions I wouldn't recommend. Well, I'll just say that.
Absolutely. So,
which, by the way, we still need to update it, but Nadia, I think last year, did a all of the how to play each of the Final Fantasies
yes,
and which one
a,
you should be. You know. We still need to update that together. Because we've had Final Fantasy 15 PC come out since then, Final Fantasy 12, the Final Fantasy 12 remaster come out since then.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, okay. So what makes it stand out? I think there's an obvious one here, Nadia. Job system, hello?
Job system, most definitely, and I was thinking about it, and I don't think the job system has changed very much at all since Final Fantasy V, and it hasn't needed to.
Yeah, it was really brilliant. There have been job systems in other games, to be perfectly honest. For example, Dragon Quest VI had a job system, and I think
3 had one as well.
Yeah, Dragon Quest 3 had one. Dragon Quest 7 didn't have one, right?
Dragon Quest VII did have one, and it took 20 hours to get to it.
Yes, okay. It just doesn't feel like it has one.
Right, exactly. No, exactly.
Yeah, Dragon Quest VI always felt like fairly simplistic, whereas the job system in Final Fantasy V has a simple but fairly brilliant conceit, which is that you level up the job, right?
Yes, yes.
And as you, by just playing with it, and as you level up that job, you unlock skills, which can be subsequently transferred to other jobs, and then you mix and match. But it's not just... So that's the basics. And so you got stuff like, I got a thief, but the thief has barehanded fighting. That's awesome.
Yeah,
you got
exactly.
a knight. You can dual wield like a ninja. There are innate skills, like the thief's caution skill that can be kind of carried over. And the stats are changed too, depending on what skill you take. So if... which job you take. So, for example, if you're using a monk, your strength will really go up. And this is pretty, like, and as you max it, so you are rewarded heavily for maxing out jobs
and
carrying that over to freelancer because that is where the stats stick.
Yes. Yes, there's a lot of ways to play with this game, and I see, just thinking back to the game, just how, yes, it is a very grindy game, but it really does reward you for sticking to it.
Yes, and I will say that it's not extremely intuitive. I remember the first time I played Final Fantasy V, just being like, what do I pick? What do I do?
It stresses me out a little bit. I mean, I totally appreciate it for what it is, and it fully deserves to be on this list 100%, but as someone who stresses out a little if I'm playing a game the right way or the wrong way, it makes me a little bit nervous.
It was funny because the original guide was not a huge help because I think it recommended basically grinding for 20 hours before you hit your first boss.
Oh no, that's bad advice.
Yeah, just a little bit. So yeah, the job system has been universally praised over the years. Let's be honest, it's very grind focused, and if you're willing to just level up jobs and put them together in a semi-intelligent way, you're going to probably blow through Final Fantasy V without a huge amount of problem, actually.
Yeah. There are a couple of moments where you absolutely have to have a skill. If I'm not mistaken, I think to go up against Garuda, you need to have the Dragoon Jump skill.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few gotcha moments like that, but they're very infrequent.
Yeah, I think what draws people to the job system in Final Fantasy V is that, maybe similar to Final Fantasy VIII, there's a just this sense of, ooh, I can break this game.
Oh, you absolutely can.
Yeah, I can do so much with these jobs. I can create all kinds of interesting combinations. It just, it demands experimentation. And I think, I think that's what has really grabbed people over the years.
Yeah, I agree. And that is definitely part of the fun. It's just sometimes I feel wrong or bad for doing that, but it's what the game wants you to do.
I mean, why would you feel wrong for experimenting, Nadia?
I don't know. It's just it's something about it is a little bit like nerve-wracking. Like I said, like, am I doing this right? Am I? Is the game going to yell at me? I don't know.
I always, the thing that always jumped out at me or I struggled with a little bit was I would pick the job and then I would have to level it up. And leveling up a job felt like a commitment.
Uh-huh, exactly, yeah.
And so I was like, what if I'm leveling up the wrong one? What if this isn't the optimal combination? Ah!
Yeah, exactly. And there's also the problem that, well, all the cool-looking jobs aren't necessarily the best jobs.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's that is unfortunate, isn't it? Though most of them are pretty solid, right? I mean,
yeah, and to be
Ninja is a really good job.
Ninja's a good job. Monk is a good job. This is also the game where the white mages have cat ears, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, it's really cute.
That is adorable.
Yeah.
Another thing that makes it stand out, I've already mentioned the humor, and we have Gilgamesh with his Excalibur.
Excalibur, yes.
My apologies. And saying things like, enough expository banter, it's time we fight like men, and ladies who dress like men.
He was great. He's actually also great in Dissidia 2, because he has that, like, you know, he tries to pronounce Kepka's last name, he just screams, it's too long!
And our villain, X-Death, is also extremely cheesy and over the top, to the point that it feels like it's almost making fun of the extremely over the top evil overlords from previous games.
Yeah, I think by that point they absolutely knew what Golbez was about, and they were like, okay, let's just make fun of ourselves.
Yes, because Final Fantasy was pretty established at this point. This was the fifth game, and the series had had immense amounts of success, and I think they just wanted to kind of have fun with it a little bit as they were, you know, doing something new. Another thing that makes it stand out, like, we don't really think of Final Fantasy V as having great graphics, but they did a really good job of making the characters much more expressive than in Final Fantasy IV. In Final Fantasy IV, the original SNES game, they would kind of, like, you know, put their head down and look sad.
And that was all they had. They were very squished. They didn't look nearly as squished on the overworld as they did in 4.
Yeah, they would jump around with the big eyes and everything. And they were very expressive characters. And you had lots of really big, beautiful sprites at certain points. And so it was not nearly as primitive as it first seemed.
No, I still like looking back at the monster designs. I think most of them are really good.
Yes. Another thing that makes it stand out, it's hard. It is a hard game. If you're just starting out. Yes. I think the thing that I really like about this game is, yes, it's hard. The first time you run into a boss, let's compare it to Final Fantasy IV. The first boss you fight is kind of the wind dragon, right?
Yeah, the mist dragon.
And even if you screw up and you hit it when it's in tornado form, it's fine.
No, when it's in mist form, if you hit it, it tells you what you've done wrong.
Yeah, it tells you what you've done wrong. It gently punishes you. Whatever, it's fine. In this one, one of the first major bosses that you run into will just friggin' steamroll you. It hits you so many times that you're just like, I can't do it. Oh my god, it's doing so much damage. Ah, and then you're dead. And so it kind of begs you to experiment with the class, with the classes and such, to try and to be able to deal with him.
Right. Do you remember who that was? Because I'm blanking on who that was.
I do not remember. I apologize. I'm doing this wrong. Ah.
No. It's just because you're right. Because yes, I do remember it was a hard battle. They want you to experiment with the class system, but
try out the monk.
Always
the monk has more HP. You're dope.
No, I want my 4 white mage party, please.
Yes, exactly.
That's
so
the way to die.
And it notably has some really nasty bosses. I think Atomos is a famous one where It will slowly, well, knock out a character and then slowly drag them toward him and eat them.
Yeah, speaking of nerve-wracking things that happen in that game.
Yes.
That's one.
Yeah, totally. So I remember that that was a thing that I think turned off a lot of people who were initially picking it up. Was just like, oh my god, this is really hard. This is a straight up nasty game if you're not prepared to do some grinding and if you're not prepared to really engage with the job system. And certainly compared to, say, Final Fantasy VII, where you had just OP materia all over the place, it was a shock.
No. I agree. Yeah, it was a challenge. It definitely wanted you to grind a bit, but gosh, it was, you know, even though it's not my favorite Final Fantasy, it sure was rewarding.
Was that the first time that you, was the first one you played Anthology?
No, I actually played the fan translation on emulator.
Oh my, well, okay, Nadia.
I'm sorry.
I eventually sought out the fan translation on emulator because I just wanted it to run better.
Yeah, I have to be honest, that was the best choice at the time.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I bought the game on Anthology. I owned it. Yeah, I didn't feel that bad.
No, to be honest. And for a long time, as I said earlier, this game felt like the forbidden fruit for a Final Fantasy fan at the time. That's why Chris Kohler went to such crazy lengths to get the game. I totally relate to what he did.
One more thing that really stands out about Final Fantasy V is the songs. I already mentioned the battle on the big bridge. I think the boss themes are in general really strong. Has a very peppy, upbeat theme that starts with Ahead on Our Way, which is the first one that plays on the title screen. And just, you want to jump on a chocobo and start going.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what Barts or Butts or whatever you want to call him, whatever you prefer. That's what the whole game is about. Technically, he's kind of a wanderer who has no specific direction to go in. And that's what that whole song really kind of conveys, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it has a likable cast. And I think one of the characters that a lot of people liked was Ferris, a pirate who initially you think is kind of a feminine dude who turns out to be a woman and is the sister of the princess. And that, I mean, the woman who is dressed up as a guy so that she can be in a more masculine job isn't exactly, you know, it isn't exactly the newest or most innovative trope. But you said, especially at this time and place, you had women were very much in a box, right? They were your fairly typical, you know, wizard. They would be wizards or they would be healers or they would be kind of mother figures. I mean, think about like the roles that women played in Final Fantasy IV, right? I mean,
were healers. Rydia was a summoner and Rosa, of course, was a white mage.
Yeah, Rydia was a victim a lot of the time in that game, right? Yeah. And yeah, so they fell into kind of the classic kind of roles where Rydia was the summoner and Cecil's wife was, God, why can't I remember names today?
Rosa
was a white mage and she was the dutiful wife, etc. So Final Fantasy V had Ferris, and Ferris was kind of rough and cool and kind of uncomfortable with just general femininity and seemed actually pretty happy being a pirate captain.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the whole idea of a pirate captain being a woman, that's, of course, there are historical examples of that, if I'm not mistaken. That's pretty cool, number one. Number two, she was best friends with the dragon. Come on.
Well, as we all know, according to history, women never did anything until the 1960s.
No, they sat on their ass and knitted all day.
But, yeah, no, so I think Ferris is a very popular character, especially in the West.
Yes, I agree.
Over the years, and I saw a note that Ferris is very popular with gender fluid or transgender gamers, and I could see why. I think that if you're a young transgender male and you see a character like Ferris, you're like, oh wow, that's kind of awesome. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. It's just really unfortunate she had like that terrible like pirate accent, I think, in the Anthology translation. I'm like, oh my Jesus.
Oh God. I mean, that's a Woolsey thing, right? Gotta have the bad accents.
Did Woolsey translate that one?
I want to say yes.
Oh, that's bad. That's a bad job by Woolsey if that's the case, and I'm usually a big Woolsey defender.
I imagine that he probably didn't have a lot of time and budget to actually get that thing out the door. But yeah, I'm pretty sure Woolsey did the original translation.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then the rest of the cast, we had Gallif, who rides down on a meteor, and he's kind of like Tella, but maybe a bit goofier.
A little bit goofier. Tella's got angst problems. Gallif yes. does not.
Yes, he doesn't. He's not on a bloodthirsty quest for revenge that will surely go wrong.
That he regrets the instant he dies. Oh dear, yes. This all went terribly wrong. How did that happen?
He also has a granddaughter.
Yes.
Spoiler alert. Gallif dies. Sorry. Gallif dies, and his granddaughter eventually ends up taking up Gallif's role. Gallif, I think my favorite quality about Gallif is that he rides down on a meteor from another planet.
You know, speaking about, like, we're talking about how the story is not as, like, in-depth as most Final Fantasy games, it still finds ways to keep you engaged. Like, why is this dude riding on a meteor? Mm. What is going on here?
I mean, it is kind of spooky at the very beginning, right? Where
right.
you see him inside the meteor, and he's basically going, I hope it's not too late. And you're wondering what the heck is going on. It's a fairly strong opening, even if it's a little goofy that Bartz is just walking around the impact crater and it's like, oh, hi. Welcome to the party. Oh, hi. Also welcome to the party. Like, the way that they gather up the crew members is pretty funny, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, it is pretty funny.
I think the thing that's interesting to me about Final Fantasy V's cast is how compact it is.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
It never really grows beyond the kind of core four. Well, yeah, the core four, and then one of them gets replaced, as opposed to Final Fantasy IV, which is constantly rotating in a fairly large cast. And that's because so much of the focus is on the actual gameplay. But I think a side effect of that is in Final Fantasy IV, it's constantly kind of disrupting you, and you could argue that that's a good thing, right?
Right, right.
Because because it's asking you to experiment a lot. But in Final Fantasy V, I think I like the continuity aspect of it. I think there is a benefit to that as well.
Yeah, I agree. I actually have to say one of the things I really don't like about Final Fantasy IV is being asked to change out all the time and sometimes not having the option to, you actually never have the option to have the party you want. It's always what the game wants to give you. And that really sucks when you want to use the Yang instead of Edge. But guess what? Unless you're playing Final Fantasy Advance, it's not happening.
All right, let's move on to best moments in Final Fantasy V. There are a couple best moments. I think one of them has to be the turtle.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't, what was it? What did you think I was doing over the past 7 centuries? Eating pizza? Thank you for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles reference.
Very, very nice.
Thank you there. Very sardonic.
Yes.
Turtle likes to call out annoying exposition. You'd think that a turtle would be a little more, I want to say, patient with that kind of thing.
It's funny thinking about it. Sardonic turtles seem to be kind of the literary norm. I mean, you got Morla the aged one from Neverending Story, who her whole thing is I don't care.
You're a turtle, I mean, life, you're just not that interested in the fast-paced life of the normies.
No, I mean, there's the turtle from the Stephen King universe, I forget its name, but it's also another turtle that's just like, whatever, if the world's getting destroyed, that's your problem, not mine. I'm a big ass turtle.
Gilgamesh's heroic sacrifice, where he is told, now die, and he goes, that's my line, and then he dies.
That's probably the best exit for a villain ever.
And then it seems to get lost in time and space, because he keeps popping up in other Final Fantasies.
I've heard that, Siegfried from Final Fantasy VI is supposed to be him as well, but they never really went anywhere with that, so I can't say one way or the other, but it's very much the same idea. You have this swordsman who is just a goof and is not to be taken seriously at all.
And finally, I think this is the moment that a lot of people would point out, is when Gallif, in the midst of his final battle, his final heroic sacrifice, which, by the way, Tella also has a heroic sacrifice. He really did just recycle this character.
They kind of did a bit.
He goes all the way down to zero HP. Zero HP! And still, somehow, is still hitting at X death, and it's actually pretty awesome.
That is how you know an RPG character is badass. They transcend. They see those numbers, and they're like, "Nope, I disagree. I disengage with these numbers," and they just keep on going.
You have any? And then, of course, after he dies, he tried to revive him with Raze and Phoenix Down, answering the question of why weren't they using items? I don't know. Does Phoenix Down? Do you actually die and Phoenix Down brings you back? No, you just faint and it wakes you up.
You faint. You go into KO, people. There's a difference between KO and death.
Yes. No, exactly.
My favorite moment, being the dragon person that I am, there's the scene where you rescue the Windrake. Because it's been hurt on top of the hill, and I have a soft spot for that scene.
I love the dragon. The dragon's rad.
Hiryu, I think that was his name.
Yes. All right. Why does it still hold up, Nadia? So, there's a reason that I picked this one over Final Fantasy IV.
Mm-hmm.
I think Final Fantasy IV is a wonderful and extremely tight game, but its main story strength is the story, and I think the story is almost better for camp than anything else.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that the story for Final Fantasy IV, while it is admirable for being one of the first games, first RPGs to really give us a story, it was basically recycled Star Wars. And as much as I still love those characters and I still love the story, I understand it's been surpassed multiple times by Final Fantasy VI alone. It has been improved upon. Whereas Final Fantasy V, in my personal opinion, I feel like that core system with the jobs is just still holds up so well, and people are still doing crazy things with it. I mean, there's that, what is that called? The four job fiesta, what they do every year?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, yes.
People are still playing with that game. They're still learning new things, and that's something very few Final Fantasy games can say.
Yeah, the four job fiesta, by the way, it's a challenge. It's an annual challenge that started 2 days ago.
Yeah, it started very recently.
Yes, and it runs until August 31st. And it's a challenge where players get one random job from each of the crystal sets in the game. And you can register a run on the site. You got to stick with those. You got to stick with those jobs and try to get all the way through the game with them. Mm-hmm. It's tough.
It is. It's like the Nuzlocke run for the Nuzlocke run.
So so you want to tweet water, fire, and earth to unlock your other jobs when you get those crystals, and then you tweet victory along with a picture of you beating the final boss to complete the challenge.
Yes, good luck.
I have friends who've done the four job fiesta. It's pretty intense for me. And you can also play like different runs. So you got a random run, a chaos run, a pure chaos run, a popular run, and a forbidden run. And you can do all jobs, 750 jobs, no 750 jobs, or classic jobs. And then you can do natural crystal only, upgrade crystals only, or fifth jobs. Like, there are a lot of different permutations.
Yeah, so that just says right there why this game still holds up. There are just so many crazy-ass ways to play it.
I think Final Fantasy V, ultimately, it's the fact that it's crazy replayable. Mm-hmm. And if you're really into it, it kind of just, it's fun and relaxing to go through and try different permutations of the jobs. I think the job system ultimately is why Final Fantasy V still holds up. And as people over time have kind of gotten used to it, they've kind of come to really love and appreciate Final Fantasy V.
Yeah, it's taken some time, but it's definitely gotten its due since, at least in here in America. Of course, in Japan, it always had its due.
And it just had such an outsized impact on the series as a whole. I mean, Final Fantasy III gave us the job system. Final Fantasy I had jobs, but Final Fantasy V really popularized it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like I said earlier, it has not needed to change very much since then.
Yes. So Final Fantasy V, number 25 on our list of the best 25 RPGs for that reason. And here's how you can play it. You can find an old copy of Final Fantasy Anthology, which I don't recommend.
No, you probably shouldn't do that one so much now.
Better is to find a copy on the Game Boy Advance. It has a much better script. Mm-hmm. It suffers a bit from the sound chip, but not nearly as much as Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah.
And it adds some additional jobs and other features. I think it adds maybe 4 or 5 new jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were quite a few, yeah.
Yeah, and in general, it is the best version if you can get a GBA and a copy of Final Fantasy V. And I don't think it's that expensive online.
No, I haven't looked, but I know that Final Fantasy VI Advance is quite expensive, so I don't know where Final Fantasy V sits.
I've still got a copy floating around my house somewhere.
Me too.
Now that I've just made the move.
Yeah.
You can also get it on the PlayStation Network. I wouldn't recommend that because that's the Final Fantasy Anthology version. with the load times and all of that good stuff. So, not ideal. I'm not sure if it ever came out on the Wii Virtual Console. I know Final Fantasy VI and IV did.
I don't think it did, no.
I don't think it ever did, because that would have been the SNES version. Right. And then there's the Steam and the iOS versions, which have really bad art.
We have very, very bad graphics, but everything else checks out, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the easiest, by far the easiest way to play it.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer, unfortunately. I mean, it's okay, I guess, but not ideal. But, I mean, not everybody can get hold of a GBA and a copy of the GBA game. This is a pretty hardcore way to do it. So, if you gotta play it, I guess mobile is a way.
And given the way that Square Enix has actually done a really good job rescuing Chrono Trigger from that disaster that, of a Steam port, I really wish they put that effort into revising Final Fantasy V and VI for Steam as well.
All right, that is number 25 on our top 25 RPGs. What do you think of Final Fantasy V? Do you like seeing it here? Do you think it should have been higher? What do you have fond memories of Final Fantasy V? Please send us a note. Drop them in the comments. And keep an eye out for our fuller write-up on the site where we break it all down for the big list. All right, Nadia, our E3 wrap-up got quite a bit of discussion going, particularly around Dragon Quest XI. Mm-hmm. Kuni Nino says, Cat's anecdote of how DQ11 is being dismissed as old-fashioned stirred up old feelings. Is it just me, or are Japanese games being ghettoized again? Xenoblade's expansion got almost no attention. USG was like the only place talking about Valkyria Chronicles. DQ11 got no push from Square Enix. Even Kingdom Hearts 3, there was a general dismissive attitude toward the game from the Western press, as if liking Kingdom Hearts is something you have to apologize for. I feel like RE2's remake is probably the only Japanese game that got a significant buzz. Shadows Die Twice and DMC5 look great, but they're treated like niche games. I actually disagree with that, because I saw
a lot of enthusiasm for Japanese games, frankly.
I think over the past year and a half, it feels like people have been celebrating Japanese games like crazy. Like, between Nier and Persona 5 and, I mean, Breath of the Wild and on and on and on. I feel like a lot of people feel as if Japanese games, if anything, are having a bit of a renaissance. It's just, frankly, DQ11 and Valkyria Chronicles are niche games in comparison to those other games. And Kingdom Hearts 3, I mean... it has a super duper passionate fan base, and I think that it will definitely get its due when it comes out. But it's also kind of known for its extremely tangled lore and for its delays. Yeah, it's kind of a hardcore thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so like RE2 Remake, yeah, I think Shadows Die Twice and RE2 Remake got plenty of buzz, and DMC5 as well. And if anything, I think Capcom's on the up.
Yeah, with the Shadow Type Twice in particular, I think, got quite a bit of buzz, which is nice, because a lot of people trust From Software for good reason.
It didn't get any buzz, and what I apologize for forgetting about it. We're fairly excited about the Tales of Vesperia port over here.
Yeah, that'll be my first chance to play it, so da-da-da-da.
As Super Shinobi says, my prediction is that the PS5 won't be released before Q4 2020. Well, a handful of next-gen and cross-gen games we're talking about at this year's E3, they're all a long way from release. The next Xbox might be targeting a 2019 release, as it was mentioned already at the end of the Xbox conference, but a delay at AMD or anywhere else in the supply chain could push it into 2020 as well. Yeah, I think 2020 is when we can expect a new console. JohnnyBoy407 says, Nadia, any plans to play the Xenoblade Chronicles 2 Torna DLC? I'm pretty pumped for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I forget when that's coming out. I think it said September. But that's actually a very interesting story plot they're going with, is Torna, of course, being the bad guys of the Xenoblade Chronicles 2 universe. This kind of shows where it all went wrong for them, I suppose. Because, yeah, they started out all, like, you know, kind of fresh-faced and happy, and it all went to hell. So we'll find out how, I guess.
Captain Oppositional says, I'm very excited for DQ11, but its September release date means I'm going to have to wait. I'd love to wait for the Switch version, but who knows when that will be released. We still have no solid release date for Dark Souls Remastered for Switch. If I recall correctly, Valkyria Chronicles 4 also comes out in September.
Oy, why?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to be in the middle of DQ11. I mean, it's going to be pretty tough.
Ooh, yeah. Well, I will have, like, DQ11 for my PlayStation 4, and I'll have Valkyria Chronicles for my Switch, so I'll find a way to make it work.
I'll be in the middle of my game of the year, FIFA. Oh, wait, sorry, I was channeling Tom.
Oh, yeah, that's Tom's influence on all of us. Like, must yes. play FIFA. What the hell? I don't even like FIFA. Why am I saying that?
Yeah, I love FIFA. Nice guy, Neon. I think it's hilarious that people take turn-based to mean ancient when some of the best modern games are turn-based. Like what? I can't think of any best modern games that are actually turn-based.
Yeah, Persona 5 is turn-based.
That is maybe an exception. I think that most of the very popular modern games are like, you know, Fortnite.
Turn-based
or
Fortnite.
Open-world games like Far Cry 5, to be perfectly right. honest. Why you gotta have bad taste, people?
Turn-based games are the way to go.
Step out. Is Symphony of the Night eligible for the official US Gamer Top 25 RPG list? It's got dat story and dem stats and all these equipments. Action RPG, like, whoa! Guess you're gonna have to find out, won't you?
Yeah, you will.
Yes, stay tuned over the next 6 months.
Don't falter now.
Rider Kicker, I have memories of spending an hour every week at the Pokemon Center after school playing its wares. I can't believe I spent so much time abusing their gift Pokemon machine, getting nothing but Salamences. Never got the Deoxys, but did get an Eon ticket. Ooh, Eon ticket. Very nice. That got you to an island that would let you get you a thing, a special thing. I want to say an Eon ticket got you another one of the flying dragon things. Why can't I remember that? I can't remember their name.
The Pokemon Center, was that the... Gosh, I'm trying to remember where that was. Was it the store in New York City, or is that something else entirely?
Yeah, so this would have been the New York Pokemon Center.
Right, before it became the Nintendo store.
Before it became the Nintendo World store, yeah.
Oh man, that'd be cool to hang out every day. I'm jelly.
Yeah, I'm super jelly too. I did get to go to the Nintendo World store, and it still had like plenty of stuff. So, and I've been to the Pokemon centers in Japan.
Then that I'd love to visit.
Yeah, they're fun. I mean, they're not amazing or anything. It's just, they're actually a surprisingly small store with a whole bunch of merch. Like, tons of merch. A lot of overpriced merch.
If you want that, like, you know, that Pokemon that's not Pikachu stuffy, though, that's your best chance.
And you can get a ton of, you can get a lot of special Pokemon there. So that was, that was fun. Yeah, going all the way back to Pokemon Gold and Silver, actually, but... Gamer Law, somewhat surprised by Kat's ambivalence toward Octopath Traveler. Given her earlier comments in the episode about the continuing appeal of turn-based RPGs, I would have thought she'd be singing its praises. I'm waiting. Oh, to be perfectly honest, right now all of my attention is taken up by Super Robot Wars. I'm on Mission 42. I just finished Mission 42. I've got like a fully upgraded party, and this is the part where it's good. And in fact, SRWV is really good. It's the best Super Robot Wars game I've played in ages.
You're kind of a by the minute person, I suppose, when it comes to these kinds of releases.
A by the minute?
Well, yeah. If something's out that takes up your attention, it's you'll give it a look, and you'll probably like it.
Yeah, I mean, I want to kind of wrap up Super Robot Wars before I think of anything else, and I still got Witcher 3 and Persona 5 sitting there,
staring at you accusingly.
Yeah, Moochan, as for cyber, I'm fine with random encounters, but after playing Bravely Default, I feel all games need to give you the option of degree of the encounters. Nadia playing FF9 shows even older games can be modified to tweak the random encounters to make it more bearable. As for Cyberpunk being FPS, I'm alright with it. Witcher 3 might be the only flaw the game has. I love everything but the combat in Witcher 3, which always took me out of the game. So them trying out FPS with Witcher's quality of writing feels like a nice move. I actually like the combat in Witcher 3. Because it's like a dance, and I think once you really get high level, it makes you feel really cool, to be perfectly honest. It's a cool dance, and also I really like the putting together your finding what skills you want to emphasize with the signs and everything. Yeah, you're OP and everything, but it really does make you feel like a Witcher. So, but I'm sure we may be talking about Witcher 3 on this list. We'll see, right? Maybe.
Wait until January.
All right. Acts of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Follow us at @_Catbot and Nadia at Nadia Oxford. And, of course, follow all of US Gamer's social media channels, US GamerNet on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all of that. We were going to have Jeremy Parrish on this episode, but unfortunately, Jeremy Parrish is not doing podcasts while he's trying to fix his air conditioning or something. But can I recommend that you check out the first in his 12-part series on the history of RPGs? He interviewed Richard Garriott and did a nice profile about all the stories that came with making Ultima, and he's kind of framing this as a series of discussions and looks at individual games as he tries to kind of find the essence of the RPG, which is not an easy thing to do, perfectly honest.
Absolutely is not. But he's, if anyone can do it, it's Parrish.
Hopefully we'll have him on the next episode, because I think the next episode kind of begs for him to be on it. So,
yes.
Hint, hint, spoiler, spoiler. So we shall see. But until then, I've been Cat Bailey, and thanks for listening. We'll be back with another top 25 entry and all of the rest of the RPG discussion. Until then, happy adventuring.